Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Sister Janet Ferns. What is the Claricus Cup? In today's program, Joan Lewis and I reveal more about this fascinating new Vatican initiative. We also take a look at Vatican exercises of a more spiritual nature. Jesus took Peter, James and John, and they went up a high mountain. In their presence, he was transfigured. Gilbert Villacqua and Sean Patrick Levitt reflect on the Gospel for this Sunday.
Jesus took Peter, John and James and went up onto a mountain to pray. While he was praying, his face changed in appearance, and his clothes became dazzlingly white. Suddenly two men were talking with him, Moses and Elijah. They appeared in glory and spoke of his passage which he was about to fulfill in Jerusalem. Peter and those with him had fallen into a deep sleep, but awakening they saw his glory, and likewise saw the two men who were standing with him. When these were leaving, Peter said to Jesus, "Master, how good it is for us to be here. Let us set up three booths, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not really know what he was saying. While he was speaking, a cloud came and overshadowed them, and the disciples grew fearful as the others entered it. Then from the cloud came a voice which said, "This is my Son, my chosen one. Listen to him." When the voice fell silent, Jesus was there alone. The disciples kept quiet, telling nothing of what they had seen at that time to anyone.
The event of the Transfiguration often tends to be limited in our perception of it to the dramatic element, the whiteness, the appearance of the two Old Testament prophets, the cloud and the shadow, the fear of the apostles, the sudden voice, the return to normality. And it is dramatic, but there is so much meaning behind the drama we may never truly penetrate it. Certain aspects, however, have been pointed out to us by scholars and preachers. Only a week earlier, Jesus had spoken of his passion and death. And in our Gospel today, we heard that Moses and Elijah spoke of his passage, which he was about to fulfil in Jerusalem. Luke was writing in Greek, and the word he used was exodos, which can mean death, but can suggest the idea that it is a passage, an exodus, towards glory, of which the Transfiguration is an anticipation. The other important point is stressed by a Cistercian monk who comments that the true lesson of Mount Tabor is not the one people often draw from it. In the mystery of the Transfiguration, the essential thing for the apostles was not so much having glimpsed Jesus in glory, but having received this command from the very lips of the Father, "This is my Son, my beloved. Listen to him." And now to that mountain. Several important moments in our Lord's life take place on a mountain or hill. The Sermon on the Mount, the temptations in the desert, and his last appearance before ascending into heaven. As these mountains are not named, a modern scholar suggests two from the Old Testament: Mount Sinai, where Moses received the tables of the law, and Mount Sion, mountain of the temple of Yahweh, which all the nations will stream to. Although both Matthew and Mark write of a high mountain, the traditional site of the Transfiguration, Mount Tabor, is less than 2,000 feet high. Some have preferred Mount Hermon, over four times as high and always covered with snow. But Tabor was considered sacred even in the Old Testament, and it's impressive enough. Luke says simply, "He took with him Peter and John and James and went up to the mountain to pray." Something he did often. Matthew and Mark add another detail. Jesus led them to a place where they could be alone, apart in the old version. And as he prayed, writes Luke, the aspect of his face was changed. Became as dazzling as the sun, writes Matthew. His clothes as radiant as light. White as the light, in the Jerusalem Bible version. Nothing could add beauty to light, wrote Christopher Wren, the great architect of St. Paul's Cathedral in London. Wren was making a report on the medieval fabric of Salisbury Cathedral and had special words of praise for its windows, which let in the maximum light. This belief led Wren to avoid the use of stained glass in his later buildings. The whiteness of our Lord's clothes, explain scholars, signify that he belongs to the heavenly world. Angels appear dressed in white. When the women go to his tomb to embalm Jesus, they find a young man in a white robe. And white are the robes of the martyrs figured in the Apocalypse, the people who have been through the great persecution and have washed their robes white again in the blood of the Lamb. In our prayers for the souls of the faithful departed, light is one of the three things we ask God to give them. Eternal rest give to them, O Lord, and let perpetual light shine upon them. May they rest in peace. The poets, too, are in agreement that the next world is one of light, wrote Henry Vaughan in the 17th century.
I saw eternity the other night, like a great ring of pure and endless light, all calm as it was bright, and round beneath it time, in hours, days, years, driven by the spheres like a vast shadow moved, in which the world and all her train were hurled.
In another poem, Friends Departed, the light they inhabit even reaches into his memory of them.
They are all gone into the world of light, and I alone sit lingering here. Their very memory is fair and bright, and my sad thoughts doth clear. It glows and glitters in my cloudy breast like stars upon some gloomy grove, or those faint beams in which this hill is dressed after the sun's remove. I see them walking in an air of glory whose light doth trample on my days, which are at best but dull and hoary, mere glimmering and decays.
A contemporary of Vaughan's, but his senior by some 30 years, Robert Herrick wrote of the White Island, or the Place of the Blessed.
In this world, the Isle of Dreams, while we sit by sorrow's streams, tears and terrors are our themes reciting. But when once from hence we fly, more and more approaching nigh unto young eternity uniting, in that whiter island, where things are ever more sincere, candor here and luster there delighting.
Gardeners, too, have written of whiteness and have even created white gardens. The most famous of these is in Kent, at Sissinghurst, and was planted by the poet gardener Vita Sackville-West. When she was making it, she wrote in her diary,
I cannot help hoping that the great ghostly barn owl will sweep silently across a pale garden next summer in the twilight. The pale garden that I am now planting under the first flakes of snow. I dare to say of white, that neutral tint usually regarded as an absence of colour, that it is every bit as receptive of changing light as the blues and reds and purples. I love colour and rejoice in it, but white is lovely to me forever. The ice-green shades that it can take on in certain lights, by twilight or by moonlight, make a dream of the garden, an unreal vision.
Up on Mount Tabor, the apostles were in no condition to be analyzing the quality of light or whiteness which dazzled them. Luke writes that they were heavy with sleep, though they clearly saw our Lord in his glory and Moses and Elijah with him. But there's a delightful homely touch in Mark's account. Mark, we're given to understand, was Peter's amanuensis. And as Peter was married, though we never hear of his wife, we know he lived with his mother-in-law. Was it not perhaps to impress upon her the brilliance of Christ's clothing that he told her and made Mark record that his clothes became dazzlingly white, whiter than any earthly bleacher could make them? I like to think it may have been so. When Moses and Elijah were on the point of leaving Jesus, we read that Peter expressed his joy and made his suggestion, though both Luke and Mark comment he did not know what he was saying. With your permission, I will erect 3 booths here. If you wish, I will make 3 tents. Let us make 3 tabernacles. The 3 words for the same thing call up different images. Booths, for me, would probably be stalls in a big field for a fair of some kind. And then there are telephone booths. Tabernacles are the precious receptacles of the Blessed Sacrament. But tents, now there's a word for you. Tents are Boy Scouts and the outdoor life, family holidays when the children were small and we could only afford to camp, Arctic explorers, mountaineers, and St. Paul. Yes, I can see St. Paul in Corinth with his sailmaker's needle, making and mending tents with his friends Aquila and Prisca, tent makers like himself. But for the Jewish people, the tent, the booth, the tabernacle is the symbol of one of their 3 main feasts, the Feast of Tabernacles, commemorating the way their forefathers lived in booths or tents in the wilderness, and celebrating the final gathering in of the harvest and the vintage. The feast, which falls in autumn, lasts for 7 days. We read in Leviticus what God prescribed to Moses.
You shall take boughs of leafy trees and willows from the riverbank. You are to live in shelters, so that your descendants may know that I made the sons of Israel live in shelters when I brought them out of the land of Egypt.
St. John, in his Gospel, mentions the feast and that Jesus went up to Jerusalem for it, but in secret. A chronicler tells how the people would build booths of green branches in the squares and on the terraces, and
as soon as darkness fell, on the evening of the first day of the feast, the priests lit great lamps hanging from on high, and immediately the crowd lit innumerable other lights of every kind.
This feast reminds me of the famous Chapter of Mats held by St. Francis of Assisi when 5,000 friars gathered on the plain surrounding Santa Maria degli Angeli, writes Omer Engelbert.
Divided into silent groups of 60, 100 or 300 men, whose sole occupation was prayer, charitably rendering service to each other, or conversing of spiritual things, a group so disciplined that it could have been taken for an army encamped.
And this was what Cardinal Ugolino exclaimed when he came to visit them. We read in The Little Flowers of St. Francis that they were so quiet and meek that there was no sound or noise. It was summertime, and so
each group had made tents covered on top and round about with rushes and mats. Accordingly, this chapter was called the Chapter of Rushes or Mats. They slept on the bare ground or on straw, and their pillows were stones or pieces of wood.
On this occasion, St. Dominic was also present and was shocked when Francis told his friars not to worry about their bodily nourishment, as Christ would provide.
He expected disaster to befall these thousands of hungry and heedless men, But the Lord showed that feeding his poor belonged to him, for a long procession of donkeys and mules was soon seen arriving, laden with bread and wine, beans, cheese, and all sorts of victuals.
Dominic had to admit the intervention of Providence, and we read,
after apologizing for having taxed Francis with blundering, he promised to observe evangelical poverty hitherto himself and to make its practice mandatory on his sons.
And to conclude these reflections on the Transfiguration, here are some lines by the Franciscan Capuchin friar Mark Elvins on the Eastern Christian understanding of the event.
In the Christian East, Christ is understood to have continuously radiated the glory of God. But because of human sin, people saw only a man. At the Transfiguration, however, it was the sight of Peter, James, and John that was transfigured. The icons show the light radiating from Christ and touching the eyes of Peter, James, and John, who thus see Christ as he truly is, with the whole of creation reflecting his glory.
From the Gospel, we move on to a mixture of Vatican tradition and novelty as Joan Lewis and I look back at the events of the past few days. Joan, welcome back for another week.
Another week, and kind of a different one this time, the traditional week of retreat or spiritual exercises in the Vatican for the Holy Father and the ranking members of the Curia. They began Sunday evening, and they conclude always the Saturday afterwards. So it's very quiet. You go to the press office, and there's hardly anyone covering the news because there's no news. Maybe a couple of appointments, but there's no audiences, no general audience.
Well, it's the same with the news here at the radio, because we normally have the Vatican update, but there's nothing happening.
Exactly. You kind of have to look for news. And as a matter of fact, when I was at the Vatican Information Service one year, when we knew we were going to have these 5 days of diet as far as news goes, maybe a couple of appointments. But you can't send a blank sheet out to your subscribers saying, sorry, there's no news today. And at Vise, the thing is, our source, unlike maybe another wire service or agency, our source for the news had to be strictly the Roman Curia of Vatican City. So if you've got no meetings, no press conferences, no speeches, homilies, audiences, you're looking for news. And so one time, as a story, I thought, well, what's the background to these retreats? When did they begin? And very interestingly, it really goes back to Pope Pius XI. And in December 1929, he marked the 50th anniversary of his priestly ordination and published an encyclical called Mens Nostra on the promotion of spiritual exercises. And you know, it always says on the cover of an encyclical or first page, to whom this is addressed, to the, you know, faithful of the world. He addresses it here to, I love this, patriarchs, primates, archbishops, bishops, and other local ordinaries in peace and communion with the Apostolic See. He looked back at the many fruits of the Jubilee year celebrated for his 50th anniversary, and he wrote, to express our heartfelt gratitude, we have deemed it fitting. Now remember, at that time, a pope did not talk in, he didn't say I for himself. He always said,
he always used the royal we.
The royal we, exactly. So he said, we, meaning himself, deemed it fitting to establish something most excellent, which will, we trust, prove a source of many advantages to the Christian people. And he said, we're speaking of the practice of spiritual exercises, which we earnestly desire to see daily extended more widely, not only among the clergy, but also among the multitudes of the laity. And then he himself, Pius XI himself, went on to talk about the history of retreats, quoting predecessors on the subject, doctors of the church, and so forth. And he declared and constituted St. Ignatius of Loyola the heavenly patron of all spiritual exercises, and therefore of institutes, sodalities, and bodies of every kind who are making these exercises. Now, of course, anybody who's ever made a retreat or looked at the history of retreats, probably the most famous one is known as the Ignatian retreat, and it does last 30 days, the Jesuit.
I've actually made a 30-day retreat, and the normal Ignatian retreat that most people would know is a small version of the 30-day retreat. And a retreat is a very special time of the year. It's a time of prayer and certainly a lot of self-examination so that you can leave the retreat with new energy and vitality and direction in life. But as somebody also described it, it's a holiday with the Lord.
That's a wonderful description. I can remember quite clearly the first retreat I ever made was in high school, and then we had, always retreats in college. Sometimes it's a little more difficult when you're out in the working world trying to ask your boss off for, 3 days or a week. You almost have to look for just a weekend retreat. But I can remember the first time I did it, I thought, isn't this going to be boring? Well, I want to tell you, if you have a really good retreat master, it is the least boring thing you can ever do. You really don't want it to end. Anyway, Cardinal Giacomo Biffi, he's the retreat master, a renowned speaker, and the former Archbishop of Bologna, who's known for sometimes, speaking his mind, if you will, on different subjects. Anyway, he's the retreat master, and, each day is identical except for the contents of the sermon. And by the way, interestingly enough, the Holy Father, as you walk in the chapel and you're looking at the altar area, there's a little room off to the right. I've seen it, but haven't been in it. I don't know if there's another altar or something. Anyway, it is in that room that the Holy Father is seated. So the retreat master does not have to wonder, is he saying the right thing or not, or watch for the Pope's reaction. I would think so. And I don't remember the year that he first did it, but this is Cardinal Biffi's second time as retreat master. So, and then, you and I were talking before the show about another piece of news, since there is so little news, kind of one of the ongoing stories.
It's moving from spiritual exercises to physical exercises.
Exactly.
And the Clericus Cup.
Well, this Clericus Cup has gotten so much attention. This is a soccer tournament for priests and seminarians in the diocese and actually of Rome and the region, I think, even of Lazio. And this was set up by the Sports and Leisures Division of the Italian Episcopal Conference, together with the CSI, which is not a crime and forensics unit, and anybody who watches TV may have known, but it is the Centro Sportivo Italiano. So the cup literally kicked off on Saturday, the 24th of February. There's an elimination phase, and then they go into the final X number of teams playing, and the absolute final of these teams from seminaries and so forth will be played in June in Rome. And so your first game was on the 24th, and that was between a group of Brazilian players, all Brazilians as a matter of fact, from the Gregorian University, and a mixed team, though mainly Mexicans, from the seminary of the Legionaries of Christ. And where a lot of people expected the Brazilians to be very brilliant, the Mater Ecclesiae, Mother of the Church, if you will, seminary, came out on top 6-0. It was a real fun game. There were several hundred fans. I think there might have been more photographers and media people than even there were fans.
Well, the seminaries might have some good players, but football isn't their main focus, so their games are just fun.
Oh, and that's the wonderful thing about it. You're not out here, there'll be some kind of a cup, but you're not out here to, set up, get a reputation for the World Cup of Soccer or something else like that. But it's gotten an awful lot of interest. And one of the things I love about the game is that the players are still asking if the seminarians from Mater Ecclesiae won because their goalie was named Jesus. So it's a great, great question. But the Mexicans did overpower the Brazilians in the professional world. You wouldn't have probably seen the same result. Right, there's 16 colleges. The CSI Spot website lists all 16. They're in two groups, Girone A and Girone B. So a real fun thing. People are watching it. Obviously, there's not a seminary in town who's unaware of this. You know,
And I'm sure that Cardinal Bertone, with his reputation for loving football, is avidly watching.
Oh, and he had a message for the players at the beginning, as did Cardinal Pio Laghi, who was there. And as happens in American baseball, you'll have a president or somebody throw out the first ball. Cardinal Laghi kicked the first ball in the game.
Great.
And the game took over from there. But I understand one little piece of trivia is that there's an Italian priest, Davide Tisato. He's 23 years old. He must have been just ordained. He used to be part of a top-notch youth soccer team in Verona. So he's playing for the Roman seminary, Redemptoris Mater. And the oldest player, this fascinates me, is a 54-year-old Basque, Father Yartza Inaki.
And having been talking about the Clericus Cup, we're still on matters clerical with the Pope meeting the priests of the Roman diocese.
Exactly. He did this just before entering in. I think it was his last audience before entering into the spiritual retreat. There's an annual meeting with the Cardinal Vicar of Rome, the auxiliary bishops, and the pastors of Rome's 338 parishes. It was 90 minutes, really, of wonderful conversation, give and take, laughs, you can't imagine, just off the cuff, questions asked of the Holy Father, and then just off the cuff answers. There was no prepared text that he read from. And apparently there were a lot of great laughs, wonderful insights, great really conversation between the bishop and his priest. Since it was off the cuff, there was no text that could be released. And so whoever was there taking notes or whatever, the Vatican released the entire text of it, I think it was 2 days later. But one of the first things that the Pope told the priest, he said, "It's good to hear from my priest." He said, "It makes me feel like a bishop." And then he spoke about the youth ministry, prayer, Eucharistic adoration, scriptures, relativism, shrines, arts. These topics were all touched on in questions. And I know one of the things, that the priest asked him, and one of the things he did talk about a few days before when he met with seminarians was the importance of daily mass, daily prayer, reading of the scriptures, and being available to people. And he very much reiterated a number of those points talking to the pastors. In particular, he talked about the importance of reading Holy Scripture, noting that the theme of the 2008 Synod of Bishops will be the Scriptures and the Bible. And he was asked by one pastor how to balance the spiritual and pastoral dimension. In other words, your time for prayer, your personal time for prayer, along with all the duties you have as a pastor. And I really loved the Pope's answer here. He was very introspective, saying, "The Gospels tell us that during the day the Lord worked. At night he was on the mountain with his Father and he prayed. Here I," says Benedict, "I must confess my own weakness because at night I cannot pray. I want to sleep." But seriously, he said, we must nonetheless find free time for the Lord.
You have been listening to me, Sister Janet Ferns, and to Joan Lewis, Gilbert Villacqua, and Sean Patrick Lovett. You can hear us all again at the same time next week, or at your leisure, by going to the internet and clicking on English at vaticanradio.org. Until we meet again, may God bless you.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.